All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. Hopefully my voice will last through the lesson this time. I think it should. This is going to be our third lesson on the Reformation. We'll do one more next week over the English Reformation, but this will end up our look at church history on the European continent for the most part. We'll come back briefly when we talk about some with the Great Awakenings and look at the influence of German Pietism on that. But for the most part, we'll be moving away from the continent from now on and be focusing more after this on English and then uniquely American Christianity. But let's go ahead and start by reviewing a little bit about what the problems were of the Reformation, or the problems posed by the Reformation for the Reformers. We've talked about this. Change is hard to control once it's been started. So once you start pushing a boulder down a hill, it's hard to control where the boulder goes and when it stops. You can't really do that, so you're out of control. And then change, or any sort of mass movement like this, is going to bring out the crazies. And we're going to see plenty of those today. And we'll continue to see them any time that we get a religious awakening. There are going to be these types of people that come out of the woodwork. And we're going to be focusing most of our time today on Switzerland. So it might be helpful to review a little bit about the Swiss Reformation. The different views between Zwingli and Luther, and we're going to add a third person to the mix today. But I want to give you the big idea once again is that Luther's position is far more conservative than Zwingli's position. Luther is, if the Bible tells me that I cannot do it, I will not do it, but anything else is fair game. And Zwingli's position is, the Bible has to tell me to do it before I can do it. So this is going to lead to Luther's Reformation being much more conservative. He is only going to pare out the things from traditional late medieval Catholicism that he feels are against Scripture. Whereas Zwingli's Reformation and Zwingli's attitude towards things like worship, decorations inside the church building, even music being used and musical instruments, and even hymns are going to be out because they are not prescribed by the Bible. So, and then the nature of Switzerland is going to come back into play here when we talk about Calvin. These are free, independent, local, little areas, city-states, basically. If you want to think about ancient Greek, they're going to be very small. And Switzerland, they're going to be separated by mountains or by, in the sake of Geneva, when we're talking about Geneva, by Lake Geneva, which is a very, very large lake. And so Geneva is going to be on one side of the lake, and then other Swiss cities will be on the other side of the lake. And eventually Switzerland is going to be divided between a Protestant side and a Catholic side. And this is going to be the way that Switzerland remains until this day. So let's get started. Now, Protestantism had another problem besides just this. And this is a problem kind of inherent with Lutheranism and Zwinglian's ideas, is that it started to stagnate. The appeal of Luther and the structure of Luther's church and everything else really did not succeed outside of Germany, and then when it spread to Scandinavia, so places like Denmark, Norway, and Sweden will become Lutheran. But these are more, not necessarily because they necessarily favor Luther's theological ideas, it's because all of these countries were undergoing really strong monarchical consolidation movements at the time. And so the monarchs were using Luther as an excuse to start seizing control of the churches and the money that the churches provided and the land that the churches had. So all of them convert. But that's it. His ideas are going to be read in France and in other places like that, but Lutheranism is not going to spread. And then after Zwingli's untimely death, his movement is also going to stagnate, and it's going to remain local. So Protestantism is in danger of one of two things. It's in danger of becoming a local kind of German Christian mutation. That's just a mutated form of Christianity that's just practiced in the German-speaking area, since Switzerland's German, Germany and Scandinavia is a speaking Germanic language. So it's in danger of that. Or, worse yet, because Protestantism has become fragmentized at this point, fragmented, it's left open to being stamped out by a resurgent reformed and politically powerful Catholicism that we're going to see start to develop during this time period. So something's going to have to change and give Protestantism new life, and that's going to be Calvin and the Reformed tradition. So Calvin's going to propose a third way, if we want to think about it that way. He's going to be born in France in 1509 in Noyon, which is in northern France, close to Belgium in that area, if you're thinking about it. He's the son of a local official, and he's an unusually bright child. By the age of 12, he's serving as the clerk to the Bishop of Noyon. And his brilliance and his intelligence is going to earn him the patronage of a very wealthy family. These are going to be the Montemores, and they are going to provide for Calvin to go to college. And they are also going to give, and the way that they're going to do this is by giving him, at the age of 12, he will start receiving benefices, just like most people did. So he would have been the pastor of a church, or he would have had these different kind of church incomes that would have supported him throughout his study. So he's sent to Paris. He's going to study at the University of Paris for a while. And after some time at the University of Paris, his father is going to remove him and send him first to Orléans and then to, Bourget to study law. And it's while he's studying law that he's going to come under the influence of humanists. Now, humanists would have been the overwhelming way that law would have been studied. This is going back to Greek and Roman ideas of law, so he would have been under the influence of them. He would have learned how to, and this is also going to be important for his time in Geneva, as far as his training as a lawyer is going to help him in reorganizing and thinking through law and the way that law works inside Geneva. That's going to be very important. He's also, while he studies in Paris, I should make note of this, is that he studies under a man by the name of Martin Cordier, who is probably the most famous Latinist of his day. Cordier is going to go on. He will end up in Geneva, and he'll end up in Calvin's school in Geneva, and will end up outliving Calvin by a few months, even though he was his teacher. And Calvin's Latin is among the best Latin that we have written. Many of his letters are still being translated. Many of his works are still being translated to Latin because they're so good and so hard to translate. They're still working on translating many of them. So, but he's going to come under the influence. He's going to graduate with a law degree. And it's during this time period, after his law degree, that he's going to undergo a conversion experience. This is going to be in the autumn of 1533. And he describes this, his conversion experience, in two ways. One of them is more of an intellectual kind of conversion, in which his mind, which has been hardened, he talks about it, is suddenly, it's subdued into a teachable frame, is the word that he uses, the expression that he uses. And this is going to open him up to being, to understanding the gospel. And the other one that he uses is, he says, being exceedingly alarmed at the misery in which I had fallen, and much more that which threatened me in the view of eternal death, I bound duty, made it my first business to betake myself to your way, condemning my past life, not without groans and tears. So this is a much more emotional type of experience that Calvin talks about. He talks about both of these as being part of his conversion experience. So it was both an intellectual type, his mind being softened and opened up to Protestant ideas, and then also a very emotional experience. And when he does this, this is going to, and in the midst of this conversion experience, he's in Paris at the same time. He's with a friend of his that he had grown up and gone to school with, a guy by the name of Nicholas Cop, whose father is the physician to the King of France. Cop has been appointed the new rector of the University of Paris. And in his first address on All Saints Day in 1533, he gives an address to the university faculty condemning Catholic kind of excesses, calling for the need of reform, and actually calling out the faculty as being part of this problem. And he's denounced this as a heretic, and he's forced to flee. And Calvin in Paris and his friend is suspected of having co-authored Cop's address with him. So Calvin is forced to go in hiding as well. Calvin doesn't flee France yet, but he does go into hiding. He returns to Noyon and renounces his benefices after this time period. And he's going to slowly make his way out of France, and he's going to travel in Germany and Italy. Oh, and this is going to be the time period after his conversion experience and his flight and his kind of wanderings around Europe that he's going to write the Institutes. His first edition of the Institutes. This is a very small. This is written in more of a catechismal kind of fashion. Questions and answers. Now, that's going to be revised later in his second edition. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it's going to be published when he's just 25 years old. Only 25. And this makes Calvin's name throughout the Protestant cities of Europe. This puts him on the map, so to speak. He's going to be a well-known person. It's going to undergo five major additions throughout his lifetime, the last being about 9 years before his death. And it will grow in length five times. So from the first to the last one is about five times longer than the first. And this is really going to be, in a lot of ways, want to set a standard for what systematic theological texts are going to be like, the way it's organized, the way it's thought through, all that kind of stuff. So this is going to be a first, really, in that way. Now, eventually, in about 1536, so after about 3 years of kind of two, 3 years of kind of wandering around Europe, the King of France engages in another war with the Emperor of Germany, and he kind of wants all of his people to come back and help him, so he announces an amnesty to all religious exiles that have been exiled from France, and Calvin makes his way back to France, kind of finishes up some business, and then because of the war, he's going to make his way to Strasbourg, which now is in France, but at the time was in Germany, and he's going to make his way there. This would have been probably the center of Protestant thought at the time. Martin Bucer is there. He's one of the great Protestant reformers. And we'll talk a little bit about him in a second, because Calvin will eventually make it to Strasbourg. But on his way to Strasbourg, he's, because of the war, he doesn't take the direct route, which from his home to Strasbourg would have just been a straight shot right over. He's forced to kind of go out of his way, and he goes through Geneva. And Geneva is a city that's culturally French. It speaks French. It thinks French. It does all this. But it has won its independence from its local kind of prince bishop that ruled it and was associated with the Kingdom of Savoy, which is would have been in kind of southeastern France, northwestern Italy. And it's won its independence from this. And this is an independence that is both religious and political. So it's both. So they kick out the Catholic prince bishop, and this means now that they are free, just not only politically, to ally themselves with the Swiss Protestant neighbors across the lake, which they do, but they're also free religiously to adopt the religion of the Protestants across the lake, which they also do. And this, they're helped in this by the city of Bern. Now, on his way through Geneva, he's stopped by a man that recognizes him. His name is William Farrell. And Farrell convinces Calvin, against his will, to stay in Geneva. Let's see, I think I have the quote here. Let me make sure. Yeah. Let's see, where is it? Oh, this is Calvin's. Then Farrell, who was working with incredible zeal to promote the gospel, bent all his efforts to keep me in the city. And when he realized that I was determined to study in privacy in some obscure place and saw that he gained nothing by entreaty, he descended to cursing and said that God would surely curse my peace if I held back from giving help at a time of such great need. And terrified by his words and conscious of my own timidity and cowardice, I gave up my journey and attempted to apply whatever I had, a gift I had, in defense of the faith. So here's Farrell, who tries to logically convince Calvin. Calvin's like, no, I don't want to be involved in this. I want to go and I want to study in Strasbourg in peace and quiet. And so Farrell resorts to cursing him, calling on God's cursing of his peace. Anyway, so Calvin is going to be here, and this is going to really mark what Calvin has in mind in Geneva as a lawyer and a theologian both. He has a very unique view of the nature of the way that the church and the state should relate to each other. So if we want to move to the next slide, yes, a new church structure. And what Calvin is interested in is a freedom of church and state. Now, this isn't what we think about now, because what he doesn't mean is that they're completely separated. What he means is that opposed to Lutheran and Zwinglian ideas where the state controlled the church, and this is going to be the case, not just there, but it's going to be the case in England and other places as well, where the church controls, the state controls the church is going to be free from the control of the state. That's what Calvin wants. He wants the church to be free from the control of the state. And he wants to be the church to be left to organize itself, to elect its own members, to discipline its members, to do all these things independent of the state. But this also does not mean that the church does not influence the state in any ways. Obviously, Calvin assumed that the people in the state would be members of the church and then therefore would be subject to the discipline of the church. So this is more of a return to, in a lot of ways, a more Catholic view of the church. The church kind of over the state, not but beside it, but still able to influence it and control it. Now, he goes about doing this through a new organization. So these are the people that he would have put, or the organization he puts in place, elders, and then the consistory, which is a council of the elders and the pastors together. The elders are lay members and the pastors are not. And then doctors are teachers and deacons. So these are the way that he structures the church. And he does this right away. He's not in Geneva 5 months before he's before the city council and has it all laid out for him. Now, this organization is not democratic either. We shouldn't think of this as some sort of democratic, right? The people are going to elect this. No. The pastors elect the pastors. The city council appoints the elders. The city council has to okay everyone on this list. So the church, the state still has a lot of control over this. And it's not democratic in the fact that, like, the churches themselves would be appointing this. So, now, another thing that we're going to think about, we need to talk about this. Now, Calvin would not have been able to do any of this. We should not think of Calvin as being the absolute ruler of Geneva. He never was. He wasn't even a citizen of Geneva for a very long time, period. But what we should understand is that Calvin would have accomplished none of this if he did not have the support of the majority of the people inside of Geneva. And we're going to see this very clearly because as soon as he proposes this, he doesn't have the support of the majority of the people in Geneva. His insistence that people take a religious oath of loyalty to the reform is not upheld. And people that don't take the oath are not punished. People that do other things, the council kind of just lets them go, doesn't enforce any sort of rules over them. The pastors in the consistory are not given the power of excommunication. That's reserved by the council. And in a religious conflict that develops between Geneva and its religious kind of protector, its political ally across the Lake Bern over the use of leaven or unleavened bread in the Eucharist, the city council orders Calvin to use leavened bread instead of unleavened bread, and Calvin refuses and does not even give the Eucharist at all at Easter. He's called into account for this, and he is exiled along with Farel from Geneva. And then Calvin makes his way to Strasbourg, where he intended to go all along. This is a picture of the cathedral in Strasbourg, just basically an excuse for me to put this picture up here, which is probably one of the most beautiful cathedrals in Europe. But this would not have been where Calvin preached. He was a pastor to the French exiles in Strasbourg, and none of the churches where Calvin preached are in existence now in Strasbourg, although there's still churches on those places. They've been rebuilt since then. But the reason why Calvin is exiled is because he tries to remove the reforms along quicker than the people in Geneva are willing to move. So he goes to Strasbourg, and in Strasbourg, this is going to be a tremendous period of growth for Calvin. He's going to publish his second edition of the Institutes there. He's going to publish his commentary on Romans. He's also going to get married there. Now, this is an interesting difference between, just to show you how the landscape has changed in Europe. Luther marries an ex-nun. Calvin marries the widow of an Anabaptist. So the landscape has changed quite a bit. He marries the widow of an Anabaptist. They will have 3 children, all of which die in infancy. And he's going to be mentored by Martin Bucer. And Bucer is really one of the most, unknown and yet important people in the Reformation. He was converted by Luther himself. Yet he leaned more towards Zwingli's ideas in theology. He debated Anabaptist leaders, corresponded with Erasmus, and he was the central political and religious leader of Strasbourg and was influential in creating the Smalcaldic League. And he was Calvin's mentor, so he bridges the whole gap. And not only this, but he's going to outlive all of that. And after the Smalcaldic League's defeat and Strasbourg is going to be reoccupied by the Catholic Church, Bucer will flee to England and will be influential in helping Thomas Cranmer during the reign of Edward VI begin the English Reformation. So Bucer's career is going to span the entirety, in a lot of ways, of the Reformation. And he's going to be mentored Calvin will be mentored by this man. And he will learn from Bucer a lot about how to work politically inside of a city well, how to bring people along slowly, not by dictating your terms. That doesn't mean that Calvin is going to in any way give up his strongly held beliefs. He's just going to learn how to be a little bit more political in accomplishing his ends. And this, you're going to see this in the way that Bucer is going to be involved in a lot of the discussions between various either Protestant groups and between the Protestants and the Catholics that are going to take place at this time. And Calvin will criticize Bucer and Melanchthon for the concessions that they're willing to make to other Protestants and the Catholics. But he will commend them for their intentions. So this is kind of the way that Calvin works. Now, eventually, in 1540, Calvin will be called back to Geneva. But he's not going to return for a whole year because he doesn't want to. He has no desire to return. He said, rather I would submit to death 100 times than to that cross on which I had to perish daily 1,000 times. So his time in Geneva was not enjoyable to him. He didn't want to go there. He's recalled. They say, come back to us. Their political alliance with Berne had turned sour, and that all the ideas and the things that kept Calvin out. Church attendance had dropped in Geneva. Things were not going well with the reform there, and they wanted him back. But he's going to wait a year before he returns. But the Calvin who does eventually come back with his family is going to be a wiser and mature Calvin, but still just as dedicated, as you could tell from his address to the city council when he comes back here. If you desire to have your pastor correct the disorder of your lives, if you have with sincerity recalled me from my exile, banish the crimes and debaucheries which prevail among you, I cannot behold without the most painful displeasure discipline trodden underfoot and crimes committed with impunity. I cannot possibly live in a place so grossly immoral. I consider the principal enemies of the gospel not to be the pontiff in Rome or heretics, nor seducers, nor tyrants, but bad Christians. I dread abundantly more those carnal covetousnesses, those debaucheries of the tavern, of the brothel, and of gaming. Of what use is a dead faith without good works? Of what importance is even truth itself, where a wicked life belies it and whose and actions make words blush? Either command me to abandon the second time your town and let me go and soften the bitterness of my afflictions with a new exile, or let the severity of the laws reign in the church, reestablish their pure doctrine. So Calvin's intentions have not changed, and you might even say, well, it doesn't sound like his tone has changed a whole lot either, but the way that he's going to go about this is going to be different. And Calvin's time back in Geneva, we shouldn't view this as a triumphant second return, and everything is great. Calvin is going to, for the majority of the time that he spends in Geneva, even after his second return, is going to be spent in conflict. Calvin still is not going to be the ruler of Geneva. He struggles with people. He calls them the libertines. These are mostly going to be made up of a group of wealthy citizens that aren't happy that Calvin wants to apply his rules to them, as well as to the poor people, that they say, oh yes, they need this, these rules, but we probably don't. So Calvin's going to struggle with these. Obviously, these people are going to be very politically connected and going to be the majority, a lot of times, of the people who make up the city councils. The majority of the people that make up the city councils are going to be these people. And Calvin is going to be threatened. He's going to think he's going to have to go into exile at least a couple more times because of this. But these council members are never going to have the power to exile Calvin again, although they will have the power to curb a lot of his reforms and a lot of his intentions. What's going to change that, though, is because Geneva is French and because the Calvin is there, what's going to happen is there's going to be a large influx of French refugees to Geneva, especially as the French Huguenot wars pick up in France and Protestantism is starting to be stamped out in France. A lot of these people are going to flee to Geneva. They're going to become citizens of Geneva. And then Calvin is finally going to have the votes to throw out the libertines. The libertines are actually going to try and stage a coup after they lose the election. And those that aren't, that don't escape are arrested and executed. And Calvin, beginning, this is in, I want to say that's in 1555 that happens. Make sure that that's right. Yep, 1555 that this happens. And he's only going to live for just a few years after this, about a decade after that. He'll be dead. And his final years are spent really in establishing the Geneva Academy. And the Geneva Academy is only going to be founded after the Libertines are gone. 1559, even though he had wanted this for a long time. He's going to recall friends to and educators that he had known across Europe to this. And it's going to be in two parts. There's going to be a humanist school, which we should think of this more like a high school type of thing for the children, the older and intelligent children of Geneva. And then there's going to be a theological seminary part to this too. So it's both an advanced high school and a theological seminary. And this is going to have a profound effect on Europe, because the academy and Geneva itself are going to become a refuge to people all over Europe. John Knox, who we'll talk about when we talk about the English Reformation, will spend a lot of time there. He called Geneva the most perfect school of Christ since the time of the apostles. People are going to study there. If you wanted to be a Protestant pastor in France, this is where you had to go. You needed a degree from here and a letter from the elders of Geneva before you could get a job in France as a Protestant pastor. And this is going to create what you're going to have, because this becomes a centralized location for education and for other things. What you're going to have is a bond that develops among the people who go to school there. They will write and correspond, and they'll especially write back and ask questions. And Geneva will become a center for kind of disseminating Reformed teaching, obviously, but also answering questions and guiding the Reformed churches across Europe. Not in an official way, but in a more unofficial way. And then Calvin will die, and this is going to take place, I believe, in 1564 at the age of 59. And let's see, I have moved to the wrong page of my notes. Yep, 1564. And he's going to be buried in an unmarked grave at his own request. He doesn't want the place for his body. Now, there's a grave in Geneva that you can go to, been to it. And this is just where they say this is the grave that they think is Calvin's. But no one knows. So, but what are the differences now between the Protestant version? So there's going to be differences on church governance and organization. Now, Calvin's is going to stand in very difference, a marked difference to Lutheran and Zwingli. Church control of government in Lutherans, state control of churches in Lutherans, Zwingli. And then with Calvin, more of a separation of the church from state control. The Eucharist, the models that they're going to use. So Luther is the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Zwingli is it's a symbol. Calvin is somewhere in between. Calvin doesn't want to say that it's just a symbol. He comes in more with Bucer that there's something that comes along with it. Consubstantiation is sometimes used, that it comes along with it. Something happens. Calvin's view of works. Calvin is going to move into, this is a different view of the process of justification and sanctification. And I'll allow someone who's much more able theologically than me to explain that. But the importance of works is going to be significant with Calvin. You heard in the quote, right? He's concerned not just with what you believe, but how you act. The only way that he can know that this idea that you hold or your conversion is real is if it has actions and if it has evidence of it in your life. So he's going to be consumed in a lot of ways with faith and with justification. He's not going to say that works are essential to what saves you, but he's going to say that they're necessary. And then their views on worship. Luther is much more in the Zwinglian mode of worship, going to remove different things from the not a mass, but the church service and the worship, that it's going to be Catholic. He's going to move away from that. But there's a lot of agreement between them as well, as we'll see here. Next slide. They're all going to affirm sola scriptura, scripture alone, sola fides, faith alone. And the nature of the church is not different among these three. All the big three reformers agree on the nature of the church as a territorial church that includes all the people. Both the elect and the non-elect. Everyone belongs to the church. And it's the same church in the city. It's not a denominational, it's a territorial model of the church. And this is going to be important because the next group that we're going to talk about is going to move away from this. They're going to have something called the gathered church. So, this is a return of an ancient controversy. What's the nature of the church? We talked about this in early church history. Is the church just the pure? Or is it everyone that claims to be a Christian? What's the nature of our church going to be? This is kind of a return to this idea. This is a controversy that existed after the persecutions. The Anabaptists are going to, having read Scripture, they are not, as we'll see in just a second, I think the next slide says this, but we don't have to move there now. They are not radicals. They are the most devout of Zwingli's followers in Zurich that become the Anabaptists. They're the ones who read the Bible the most, who meet in private Bible studies that he sets up for them. They read the Bible, and they believe that the Reformation isn't moving fast enough. We're not moving as quickly as we need to back to the New Testament church. And they're going to have a number of issues with this. Now, the problem is that people like Zwingli and people like Luther and people like Calvin have to do two things. They have to try and move the Reformation along and at the same time not lose the political support that makes the survival of the Reformation possible. If Luther, like when Luther returned from his Wartburg exile, had come back and just gone along with the radicals, he would have lost the protection of the Duke of Saxony and the Reformation would have been stopped very quickly. If Zwingli had gone along with the Anabaptists, the city council in Zurich would have expelled them all and there would have been no Reformation in Zurich. So these people, the leaders of the Reformation, a lot of times you have to understand a lot of times we're like, why didn't they go along with this? Well, it's because, you know, they didn't just have theological concerns. They had political concerns, and they were concerned with not just how can we move the Reformation, move theologically back to where we need to go, but how can we all get there alive and not be dead when we get there and make sure that this continues. So, and they're also going to have the Anabaptists, because of the persecution that arises around them, and we'll look at that in a minute, they're going to have a very different view of the role of the Christian in the world. So the Christian should withdraw completely from the world. So this is a view, not a new view. The Anabaptists aren't the ones that come up with this. This has been a view that's been around with Christians for a long time, ancient view. But they're going to be, the return of this view is going to be the Anabaptists. The world in its entirety is evil. Government, the church is evil too, unless you're part of the gathered church. And we need to remove completely from this. This is a woodcutting of an Anabaptist being drowned. Because the Anabaptists believe in rebaptism, the typical mode of execution that was used with them was drowning. And so, next slide. Okay, so the origins. Here is Conrad Grebel, a picture of Conrad Grebel painting. It's not tied to the radicals in Wittenberg. We should not associate the people like Karlstadt and other people like that and the peasant revolt and people like Thomas Munster and other people like that with the Anabaptists. Historians have looked at that and tried to draw connections between them, but have not found any. Where it does begin is among Zwingli's most devout followers in Zurich. Reading the scripture, Conrad Grebel is going to believe that infant baptism is wrong, that it is, you know, you have to be baptized after your conversion, and that this is necessary. And so in January of 1525, he's going to be rebaptized as the first one to be rebaptized, and then other people are going to be rebaptized after them. And because of this, and because of his inability to change his beliefs or his refusal to change his beliefs, he and his followers are going to be expelled from Zurich by the city council. And this is going to lead to a problem that we'll talk about in a minute. But this exile of the Anabaptists isn't going to lead to their destruction. It's actually going to lead to the rapid spread of their ideas, because all you're going to do is scatter them all over the place. And they're going to spread their ideas, which they do. They spread their ideas all over what's going to be the area around Zurich. So we should think of the Rhine Valley all the way up into kind of that border between Germany and France. And then up into the Low Countries of Belgium are going to be areas where Anabaptists at this point are going to be. So what are the problems with Anabaptists? Why are they persecuted so much? We don't see Protestants and Lutherans and Calvins and Calvinists and Lutherans killing each other. We don't see Catholics and Lutherans, at least at this time, killing each other and executing each other and burning each other at the stake anymore. Why do they do this to the Anabaptists? Why are the Anabaptists so singled out for destruction? Well, there are a lot of reasons. And they're not all religious. But their religious ideas do have political consequences that the people are not going to tolerate. And what are these? They're going to reject the church and the state. So this is kind of a return to, like I said before, of Donatist or Novatian heresies in a lot of ways. They're going to separate themselves. If you rebaptize, basically what you're saying is the original baptism and the churches that practice that original baptism are not true churches. And so this is going to be an affront to the churches that they rebaptize from. So obviously that's going to put them on their bad side. Social reform movements are going to be associated with Anabaptists. Anabaptists are going to be big on the social problems. Now, that might be great, except for the fact that the Anabaptists arise at the same time that the Peasants' Revolt in Germany is being crushed. So anyone that's talking about any sort of social reforms are going to be viewed as, hold on, didn't we just kill 100,000 peasants over here in this part of Germany because they were saying the same thing? He's saying the same thing. Kill him. So, not going to be tolerated. We do not want to upset the social order. This is what the Anabaptists were not concerned about. That the major reformers were much more concerned about keeping their movement alive and politically on the good side of the political powers where they lived. And also they're going to reject the state. Radical pacifism. Refused oaths of loyalty in court or in the city. And many Anabaptists are going to demand the abolishment of private property. Once again, returning to that what they viewed as a New Testament idea of what the church was. Now, these are problems. Radical pacifism doesn't sound like a bad deal until you realize that, wait, there are millions of angry Catholics over there that might invade at any moment. I want to be sure that everyone in my city is willing to fight to save us. If everyone in my city just says, nope, not going to bear arms, yeah, just come on, kill me. You might believe that. I don't. I'm going to die because of you and because of your refusal. So political stability is going to be a problem. Oath of loyalty. Why won't you just take an oath that says that you're loyal to the state? Are you not loyal to the state? No, I'm not. Okay, well, a radical. You're dead. And the demand for the abolishment of private property. Once again, this is a return in a lot of ways to a lot of the demands that the peasants were making all over Germany. And in England at this time, in the Peasants' Revolt in England, the abolishment of a lot of property rights. And so, obviously, they are radical people that deserve to be killed. You're trying to upset the social and the political order. You are a traitor. Not just that you're a heretic. Oftentimes, they're not burned for their heretical beliefs, other than that their heretical beliefs are symptoms or going to lead to political and social consequences that threaten to upset the state. And so they're executed in a large part, not just for their theological beliefs, but for their kind of political and social treason aspects that are involved in their thought. So consequences. They're going to be persecuted, not just by Catholics, but by Protestants too. And we talked about all those, but they're going to expand rapidly. Anywhere that they can find a ruler who is either sympathetic or just doesn't care, they will arrive and start spreading, and they'll become very popular. They're going to be in Switzerland, they'll be in the Netherlands, they'll be in Eastern Europe, especially after the radical Anabaptists take over in Germany and in parts of Germany. So move on to the next place. And we're going to get to the crazies. Because what's going to happen with these Anabaptists is, as the Anabaptists and the Protestants and the Catholics kill off the more sane Anabaptist leaders, that's only going to leave the crazy people to take control. And that's what happens. One of Martin Luther's disciples accepts Anabaptist beliefs, and he starts this calculation that the world is going to end in 1533. When it doesn't happen in 1533, two of the disciples say, well, no, his calculations were only slightly off. It's going to end in 1534, and it's going to take place in this German city called Münster. And so they seize control of the city. One of them is killed with 30 men when he goes out with 30 men to attack the entire Protestant and Catholic army that's surrounding him, because he believes that he's the second incarnation of Gideon. The other one, John of Leiden, stays there and proclaims himself the descendant of King David. And reinstitutes polygamy and a number of other things. And the whole city is going to be destroyed. And everyone in it that espouses Anabaptist beliefs are going to be killed. The three ringleaders that they catch are going to be tortured and killed. And their bodies are going to be hung in these cages that, if you go to Munster, you can still see hanging on the cathedral tower. Their bodies will be up there for about 50 years. And it's not for their theological beliefs, necessarily, other than the fact that this is where... All this does is just reemphasize that if we allow the Anabaptists to exist, this is what we can expect. Political disasters and social disasters are going to take place. The fabric of society is going to unravel around us if we allow them to continue in existence. And so they're going to be persecuted. And most of them are going to end up fleeing to Eastern Europe. And the later Anabaptists, which are much saner, are going to, while the radical Anabaptists nearly produce a fatal combination of events that destroy the movement, the Anabaptists are going to be able to survive on the edges of European society. So they're going to be in Hungary, in different places like that, on the very edges of European society, where they're going to exist comfortably with other crazies that are going to pop up at this time. The Unitarians develop during this time, so radical anti-Trinitarian thought is going to develop, and they're going to be pushed out, just like the Anabaptists, and going to find places to exist in the modern-day Anabaptists that are still around. We have the Mennonites from Menno Simons, the Hutterites, and the Amish people are all modern descendants of these, because they're going to travel to America where they can have religious freedom from Eastern Europe, and they're going to have settlements in Pennsylvania and other places in America that allow for them to be religiously able to practice their beliefs. Okay, so divisions of Protestantism. Here we have England, and the Lutheran areas are in kind of, it's not a great map, but the lighter kind of peachy color is Lutheran areas. And then the darker color are Calvinist areas. So you see there's Calvinists all the way over in Hungary. And then all these little triangles are going to be Huguenot centers in France. So you're going to see even the Reformed tradition in France is going to be very important. We're not going to have time to talk about that here. But just know that it is. France at one point is estimated to be probably somewhere around 30% Protestant during this time period. Now it's going to be crushed by the Huguenot Wars, but that's going to be part of what happens. So the spread of Calvinism from Geneva, you see, goes up to the Netherlands, goes to Scotland, goes to France, different places like that. Okay, next slide. The Catholic Counter-Reformation. Now, a lot of people now don't like the term Counter-Reformation. They talk about the Catholic Counter-Reformation as just being part of the general Reformation that was going on at the time. I still think the term is helpful, but the origins of the Counter-Reformation are going to be this Reform movements that spawned the Reformation as well. The same Reform movements that spawned Luther are going to spawn Calvinist reformers. We have the Spanish Reformation. We talked a little bit about that last week. But the Queen, who sends Columbus off to discover America, not intentionally, but accidentally discover America, also is involved in reforming her kingdom in Spain. And this is going to lead to the Spanish church being the strongest and best-run church in Europe. And new religious orders are going to be part of this. The Jesuits are going to be founded in Spain by a Spaniard, a guy by the name of Ignatius of Loyola. Here's a picture of him. He was a Spanish knight who was wounded in battle, could no longer fight, and so he decided that he was going to become a soldier of Christ instead. At the age of about 30, he goes back to school with a bunch of kids to learn Latin. And eventually, within a few years, is studying at the University of Paris, where he gathers around him a group of like-minded individuals who start the Jesuits. And the Jesuits, in addition to the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, also pledge a vow of loyalty to the Pope. And they are going to be the great Catholic workers and doers during the Counter-Reformation. They're going to be the great mission people of the Reformation. One thing that Because Protestantism is so consumed with saving itself from outside attacks, Protestantism isn't going to be consumed really with spreading the mission movement beyond its general area. But the Catholics are. They're going to missions to North and South America, Africa, Europe, Asia. Francis Xavier, one of the six guys that started the Jesuits with Ignatius, will die on a beach in China, taking the gospel to China. And the final thing that really sets the Counter-Reformation going is the Council of Trent, a new council that's going to be called in Trent. All right? But what's going to happen with the Catholic Reform Movement is it's going to become divided. You have two sides within the Catholic Reform Movement. About 7 minutes, right? Would I have about 7 minutes? Yeah, I saw you. Sorry. So two Reform Movements that are going to... You have a liberal Reform Movement that is going to be... willing to make theological concessions to the Protestants. The guy, the Catholic bishop, the cardinal who's really in charge of this, goes really far towards accepting Luther's statement of justification by faith alone. He says, I think we can do that. And they're also going to propose major practical reforms. All the things kind of that Luther and a lot of other people were pushing for, major practical reforms, they're going to be pushing for that. So you have them on one side, and they're going to be very influential in calling a number of kind of colloquies together with Protestant leaders to try and work out a reunion of the two churches back together. They're going to be very influential in doing that. These are going to happen. There's going to be one at Worms. There's going to be one at Regensburg in Germany. Most of these are going to take place in Germany. But then you have conservatives. And they're only going to say, we're only going to do minor practical reforms. We're just going to get rid of the excesses. We're not going to change anything big. And we're not having any sort of theological concessions. Now, because the liberals are not able, in this brief period they have about 10 or 15 years, really, that they can work with. Because they're in this period, they're not really able to work out a reunion between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church. They start kind of declining in importance, and the conservatives really start picking up. And by the time that the Council of Trent is called, now, you would think the church is split, it's divided, there's a lot of stuff going on. You would think that the church would call a council pretty quickly. Trent doesn't start until 1545. Almost 30 years after Luther posts his 95 Theses on the wall. And this is for a lot of reasons. One is because the French king and a number of other kings are happy to see Germany split up and divided over this. So there are political reasons involved, but there are also some religious reasons as well with this. But what the Council of Trent is going to do is it's going to issue definitive statements condemning Protestantism and upholding traditional, or what they would view as traditional Catholic beliefs. Now, after Trent, there can be no confusion about what a Catholic believes anymore. There's no confusion. You're not able to say, well, this could be. No. It's all spelled out in black and white. And what's going to happen is they're going to lose a lot of the liberal Catholics. A lot of the more reform-minded people are going to go over to the Protestants. But the ones that they save are going to present a solid front of belief and practice and a reformed Catholic Church that's reformed out of a lot of the bad excesses that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And this is going to lead to confronting a Protestantism that is now fragmented into different beliefs and that has become radicalized in a lot of places. And this is going to lead to the reconquest of Poland, Austria, France, Bohemia, Hungary, and Belgium. All at one point were Protestant or a large minority Protestant and will become solidly Catholic by the end of the time period of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. And they're going to do this because the rulers of these regions will support a Catholic return. They become disenchanted with Protestantism because of either theological controversies or radicalization among Protestants or a number of other reasons. And this is going to lead to a state-sponsored return to Catholicism. And this will lead to religious wars. The religious wars of the 16th and 17th century will come about because these leaders want to return their state to Protestantism or Catholicism or whatever we want to talk about. So you have the French Wars of Religion, which are also tied with the French succession of the crown. The Dutch Revolt, where the Spanish Netherlands rebel against the King of Spain because they are Protestant and he is Catholic and he's trying to force his Catholicism on them. The English Civil War, which will develop over an English king who's Catholic and the people are majority Protestant at this point. And then the Spanish Armada, which is part of this English and Spanish and Dutch conflict that's going on. And this will eventually lead to the greatest of all the religious wars, the 30 Years' War. And this is going to rage over Germany for 30 years, just about, 1618, 1619 to 1648. And the origins are going to be the failure of the Peace of Augsburg. The Peace of Augsburg is that one, his region, his religion. Well, it only recognizes Lutherans and Catholics. It doesn't recognize Calvinists. So as Calvinism grows, that's out. Outside alliances are going to start taking place so that any little conflict is going to bring in bunches of people, kind of like World War I. And then this conflict is going to be the Bohemian succession. The king of Bohemia has made concessions to his Protestant subjects, When he dies without a child, his heir is the Holy Roman Emperor, a guy by the name of Ferdinand II. Ferdinand II is not inclined to offer any more concessions to his Protestant people. He sends four guys to Prague to kind of enforce his rules. The nobles of Prague take these four guys. Two of them, they say, you guys are innocent. But you two guys, not so much. And they throw them out of a third-story window, and which they fall roughly 70 feet down and don't die, surprisingly, because they fall in a refuse pile is the thing. And if you think about a medieval city, no sewage system. Refuse is not like, oh, it's just garbage. No, it's not just garbage. It's mostly not garbage. It's mostly other things that you don't want to fall in. So that's what they fall in. Obviously, this sparks a war. The Bohemian phase, there are a lot of phases to this war. If we can move to the next slide. A lot of phases. There's the Bohemian phase in which the Bohemians are very quickly conquered by the Holy Roman Emperor. The Danish king then gets involved. He's a Protestant who has territory inside the German Empire. And he's worried that if the German Emperor is able to crush the Bohemians, his German territories might be next. So he enters. He is rather quickly beaten. And then this is the Swedish king, a guy by the name of Gustavus Adolphus, enter the war. They have German territories as well and are worried about their German territories. And unlike the Bohemians and the Danes, the Swedes are really good fighters and are able to relatively easily destroy the imperial armies at a number of battles until Gustavus is killed in the final one of these battles, the Battle of Lutzen. And then all this time, in every one of these phases, the French, also Catholic, have been supporting monetarily all the rest of these, the Bohemians, the Danes, the Swedish, they basically footed the entire war bill because they are enemies with the Habsburgs who rule both the German Empire and the Spanish Empire, which are on both sides of France. So they supply. And once the Swedish king dies, Sweden is kind of out for a little while. The French step in and begin the war openly. Then the Swedes get back in, and the Swedes and French together are able to crush the Empire. And the emperor, when we get to the Peace of Westphalia, which ends the war, is really going to set Europe's religious boundaries permanently. The areas that are Protestant have been saved by the Protestants from the empire are going to remain Protestant. The areas during the war that the empire was able to reconquer are going to stay Catholic. And the political boundaries are basically going to remain the same until Napoleon gets around, about 150 years later. Now, this is a big one. It's also going to be, in a lot of ways, people mark this as the death of religion in Europe because of all the wars that were fought over religion, all the people that died. It's estimated that about 20 to 50% of all the Germans died during the 30 Years' War through disease and other starvation and famine that the armies wandering across Germany would have caused. That people kind of lost interest in the same way that they had about religion before this. And because the religion and the way that religion spreads in Europe really stagnates, this is going to produce a beginning of a decline in religious interest in Europe that's going to eventually lead to this idea of Europe being not as a religious place it used to be. And there's just death and destruction in general. The Swedes are estimated to have destroyed a third of every single town in Germany. A third of all the towns, cities, castles in Germany were destroyed by the Swedes in their marches across Germany. So just death and destruction in it. Any questions? That's about where we're going to end. This is what the map of Europe kind of looks like at the end of the 30 Years' War. And we'll get to the English Reformation next week. Any questions about Calvin or the Anabaptists, Catholic Counter-Reformation? No questions. All right. Well, thank you guys. You guys are dismissed. Appreciate it.